Okay, so we'll get started. So, how many of you have read this in New York Times today? You have no homework, you should at least be reading New York Times, right? So this was, on the front page today, I think. At least it's on the front page of the internet one for a while, and then it's certainly, I think, in the front of the printed version. So this one just says, "Closed says Google, but shop signs say open." And the story, if those of you have read it, is Google has this thing called Places. You can take over if you want. And then I'm sorry for the confusion. Google has this thing called Places, and you would be better off here. And you can actually apparently give information as to whether a place is open or closed. Crowdsourcing. Now, it turns out that essentially a huge number of places which Google says are permanently closed are actually open. And they're wondering why nobody is coming to have food in them, et cetera. And, obviously, it's a classic example of what cardinal principle we talked here is being violated by Google thinking that people will give free information about whether or not stores are open.
Stores are the competence, and they have done that.
That's the big idea. It's a jungle out there. It's adversarial. Okay? And this is just the latest of the examples of search engines are depending on human goodness, which actually doesn't exist, because especially behind the screen, so for example, many people who don't like, let's say if I have another coffee store right next to this coffee store, I want to see this closed so that people will come to me. So I'll just go and say, "Here, it's closed." And you want more votes? Yeah, my wife, my son, everybody will log on and say, "That guy is closed." Okay? So the question again is, remember, how do you make sure that freely submitted information is actually trustworthy? And they are not making sure, and so that was the issue. There was another variation on this. So for example, for a while it used to be the case that if you click on the ad and you get to the site, the AdWords, and you go to the site, then essentially the advertiser has to pay a certain amount of money to Google, our search engine. So if I want to run you are my competitor, I want to run your advertisement budget down in like a day or two. What do? I'll have my bots clicking, 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 so that very easily your advertisement budget goes out the window. Yes. It started afterwards. So the general assumption in internet seems to be not to follow this. Essentially act as if people are going to be nice until New York Times writes an article, saying that you're being stupid, and then say, "Oh yeah, we'll fix it just now." Do you see what I'm saying? So, but that's the reality. Web is adversarial, and if you somehow thought that you can get by with, thinking that people will be nice, then you'll pay for it. So that's example. I think there's an advantage for running a course where New York Times works with you and writes articles that I can just show in the beginning of the class. So in fact, I think if you're not doing anything else, you should be reading, popular press, I guess. Okay. That's about that. Couple of things. After today's class, you will be. I think after today's class, you'll be ready to be able to do the project part one. Okay. So in fact, between now and next class beginning, I would have put the project part one up officially, and it'll be the easy part. It essentially, it'll give you a crawl of documents, and it'll also give you an index, and then all you have to do is essentially use the index to, compute vector similarity, which we're going to discuss today. Okay, so that's what you're going to do, and then so that particular thing will be up by next class beginning. Okay. One other thing, if I forget to, I probably should send this mail to people in general, but since everybody's here anyway, if you are printing slides, I mean, I kind of should have said this in the beginning class, but maybe I didn't say it. If you're printing slides, there are two things you should keep in mind. First of all, I tend to have one set of slides for a whole topic. And so I wind up sometimes going back and adding slides after the class is over to reflect the discussion we had. That's something to keep in mind. And the second, the big thing to remember is never print, I mean, the hidden slides, because there's a large number of slides there which I never show. Okay, so if you just, you know, if you're in PowerPoint and you're printing slides, then you will get a whole bunch of extra things. It's not that it's a bad thing, you will learn more stuff, but, you know, at least you would think that why did he go from this slide to this other slide to this slide? Well, it's because I didn't go to the middle one, you know, in the class at any rate. So a whole bunch of slides are hidden, and I just leave them that, you know, hidden there. So when you're printing, make sure that you don't print the hidden slides. There's a way of doing it in PowerPoint. And same thing when you're watching the slides, you know, do it in the slideshow mode so you won't see the hidden slides. So you will know for sure what I have shown you here. Okay? So just keep that in mind. And then once the topic is over, that's when the slides are stable. That's for sure. But, you know, it's okay if you want to print something to bring to the class beforehand. Okay, so we were talking about bag similarity last class, where documents are seen as bags and the queries are seen as bags, smaller bags, and we are computing the similarity between two bags, right, using Jaccard similarity. And we could do normalization of the bags, normalization of the similarity, that's what we were talking about here. Okay. So in some sense, it's as good as it gets. When we go to vector similarity, one of the interesting questions you have to keep in mind is, why do we need one more similarity measure? Okay. I will answer that question sort of today, but it will really become clearer as we go forward. In essence, the view of vectors, I mean, the short answer is, we know a lot more math about vectors. Okay. If you view pages as vectors, then one of, you know, the entire linear algebra is at our fingertips now. Okay, we don't have an algebra of bags. We have an algebra of vectors. And in particular, one of the most important aspects of linear algebra, all of you should have done linear algebra, right? So do you guys remember this notion of rank of a matrix, for example? Okay, and if a matrix has a rank less than its size, that means what, for example? That means the vectors are linearly dependent. Okay, one central issue in linear algebra is independence, linear independence of vectors. And it becomes very important for, you know, us, if we are watching, if we are viewing documents as vectors, then there is this very interesting question as to, you know, for example, a lot of independence assumptions get made in assuming they're vectors, and if you want to improve on those independence assumptions, you need to use linear algebra, which will tell you, you know, which gives you some ideas as to how to capture dependence between vectors. So that's the really the reason why we use vector similarity, not because if everything else is same, vector similarity is somehow more good at capturing the similarity than the bag similarity. It is the additional mathematical apparatus it provides, because we make a huge number of assumptions, you know, which we make here too. For example, it's one thing, so we can say this even here, it's one thing that as long as if you think of bags as this is made up of 5 apples, 4 oranges, and this one is made up of 3 apples and 2 oranges. This is the kind of bags we have looked at. Okay. Now, of course, if you have, you know, a bag of words, okay, for example, in fact, how about, you know, if you're into fruits anyway, 5 oranges, 4 navel oranges, 8 tangerines, and 3 nectarines. Okay, and then I have another bag which says 14 nectarines and 3 tangerines. And a third bag which says, let's say, 85 oranges and I mean and three nectarines. Okay, that's actually there's no nectarines actually here. 14 pairs. What would you say? You know, we got into a fruit market today. The point is, if you know your fruit, you know which bags are more similar to each other. None of them are equal. Would you say compared to this bag, is this bag more similar or this bag more similar? So one has four oranges, five oranges, four navel oranges, eight tangerines, three nectarines. The other one has 14 pears and three tangerines. The third one has 85 oranges and three nectarines. And one can argue, you know, if you are from the Florida citrus growing region, that this is a citrus bag, mostly citrus. It's all citrus, you know, orange, navel, orange, you know, tangerine. And this one is orange too. So really oranges and oranges, those two bags are very similar. Okay, now that argument assumes, I mean that argument violates the implicit assumptions we had before, which is all fruits are orthogonal to each other. They have no connection with each other. If you eat 18 oranges, you will still not know anything about a tangerine. Do you understand what I'm saying? So bag similarity assumes all fruits are orthogonal. But fruits are dependent, fruits are correlated. Some fruits, and so when the correlation exists, then if you take that correlation into account, you may be able to tell the similarity better. In some sense, that's also true for words. You know, if you think in terms of, you know, files of words, you know, bag similarity metric is going to look at each word to be an independent word from every other word. But computer always seems to go with science. Right? Data seems to mostly go with structure. See what I'm saying? So words are correlated. And if you are not capturing that correlation, then in essence you are not capturing the similarity as well. Okay? When you want to do that, then you essentially need to think about dependencies between terms. Dependencies between terms. And when you do that, the mathematics of linear algebra and basically linear dependence, linear independence between vectors winds up being very helpful. That's like two classes from now, maybe three classes from now. But that's the reason why we like vector similarity, which everybody uses. Okay? So that's the reason. Okay, so, but you know, thinking of them as vectors are not that hard really, because if you go back to this picture, right? So here are the terms, here are the documents. Okay, we just chose to think that this document is a bag of these terms. But without changing anything, I will also like to say that this document is a vector in these dimensions. Each term is a dimension. So obviously these are not vectors that you can draw or even visualize in MATLAB, right? Because these are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 dimensional vectors. These are 6 dimensional vectors. Okay, but each document is a vector in a 6 dimensional space. It's a point in 6 dimensional space. If I view them that way, then what can I say about similarity between points in the space? So you can talk about distances, right? So for example, if I, you know, let's start thinking in the 2 dimensional case, because I get to draw it here. Okay, so here is the computer. And here is science, let's say. Okay, so I can have a document D1 which says 12 computers and 12 sciences. Okay, so presumably that document kind of corresponds to that. Right, another document D2 is 12 computers, 11 sciences. Okay, so if it is 11 sciences, presumably it will be like that. I mean, basically I just made computer to be this axis and science to be that axis. Right, okay, and then, you know, I can also have a third document, D3, which is just 3 computers, and a fourth document D4, which is 1 computer and one sign. All of these can be seen as vectors, right? So the third document, basically three computers, so it'll be like this. Okay, so 3-0. And the fourth document is one computer and one science. It's like this. Now, look at these documents and say, I need to come up with similarity matrix here. Okay, obviously the distance measures between things in the space. Okay, the most obvious similarity measure you can come up with is Euclidean distance between points. Okay, so I can just compute this distance. That would be, the more the distance, the lower the similarity. Right? So that's one idea, Euclidean distance. What other idea do I have?
Angle between them.
Angle between them. Okay, which is basically, I would like to say these two are very similar. And one way of saying this is that their angle is close to zero. If the angle is close to zero, I want to say they're very similar. So do you know of any function which when the angle is zero becomes one? Because there are many, but cosine, you know, is a good measure, okay? So the cosine theta matrix. In fact, Euclidean distance, when you're thinking in terms of Euclidean distance, there is another distance called dot product distance. And a dot product distance essentially is, if I give you a vector 4i, plus 5j, where I guess is computer and j is science, and another vector 3i minus no plus 2j, then the dot product is basically 4 times 3, 12, plus 5 times 2, 10. That's the dot product. That's 22. Okay? So if you don't like Euclidean distance, for example, you can consider dot product distance. And then you also jump to cos theta distance, cosine theta distance. But what can you say that's good about cosine theta distance as against, let's say, Euclidean distance?
What about
1, 1, and 12, 12. That's the thing, which is basically, we remember we said, really, you can think of this 12-12 guy as a 1-1 guy repeated 12 times over. And we do not want similarity to be increasing or reducing. Okay? So basically, if you do that, then essentially 1-1 and 12-12, the distance between these two points is this much. And yet you want to say it's zero. Right? Right? Okay. So how can I normalize this Euclidean distance? Just take the unit vector in the direction. Okay? Right? So the normalized, remember again, this is from your linear algebra time. Okay? So what is the unit vector in this direction? 4i plus 5j by 1 of 16 plus 25. Square root of 16 plus 25. That's the L1 norm. That's the Euclidean norm of the vector size itself. Basically, all you are finding is the distance from 0, 0 to the tip of the vector. Okay? And if you divide that magnitude, I mean the vector by its magnitude, then you get the unit vector in the same direction of that vector. Now if I start considering the Euclidean distances between the unit vectors corresponding to two documents, then I will get normalized similarity measure.
But then that's almost like finding the angle.
Well, it's almost, but not exactly the same. Okay, so if I do the same thing, so if I get two unit vectors in the direction of those two documents and compute the Euclidean distance, that's a normalized Euclidean distance measure. Normalized Euclidean distance measure. The other possibility is do the same thing for the dot product. Normalize the dot product too, because dot product also depends on the size. Okay, so what I would do is I would take the dot product divided by the magnitude of the vector v1 times magnitude of the vector v2. Yes? No, that gives me exactly I mean, well, it gives me something, and it turns out it is what?
If you have just computers and just science and crops, and you end up with
that product would be zero.
Case, yeah.
So the most beautiful thing about dot product is that when a dot product between two vectors is zero, what does that tell us? This is linear algebra.
They're perpendicular.
Right? Okay. So there is one game that we'll play here. One is that you tend to, when I say a vector, you tend to think in terms of vectors in two dimensions. Those of you who are more adventurous may think of vectors in three dimensions and make some mistakes. All of you would make mistakes when you think of n-dimensional vectors. Our intuitions are pretty darn bad about n-dimensional vectors. Okay. That's a little, I want to make that that digression, because you want to keep that in mind, which is n-dimensional intuitions. For n to be much larger than 3. Because remember, here the n-dimensional intuitions we need is 6-dimensional. For a normal document, you need essentially the size of the vocabulary in which the document is written. So you're talking about million-dimensional documents. Okay? So here is my question. So since I'm into fruit, let me think of 3-dimensional apple, which you know, right? Suppose I have a peeler and I peeled the 3-dimensional apple. What percentage of the apple's volume is still left? Close to 100, right? Otherwise, why the heck would you peel apples, you know? Right? Do you understand what I'm just saying? So you took your apple and, you know, you didn't want to eat the, I guess, the peel, so you peeled it. And what percentage is left? So the fraction, the percentage of the apple left, the fraction of the volume of the apple left divided by the volume of the original apple, that's close to 100%. Agreed? What do you think if I do the same thing for a million dimensional apple? What's your intuition? What would be the amount of volume that would be left after you peeled a million dimensional apple? But remember, the point about peeling is this. Suppose I have an apple, by the way, 2-dimensional apple is just a circle. 3-dimensional apple is the apple, okay? So when I say peel, unless you have one of these really bad peelers, I hope that you peel about an epsilon, just an epsilon thickness, right? Okay, so I'm only peeling an epsilon thickness. And everything that you ever learned is telling you that most of the apple should be left. What would you say if I tell you that you would have 0% apple left if you were to peel a million dimensional apple? That's what happens. Why does that happen? It's not hard to see. It's just that we don't put two and two together. I mean, the way we live our lives is we know a fact here, we know a fact here. We make sure that those two facts never talk to each other so that we can live a good life, right? That's true, because if we actually ensure consistency in our head, we will learn something, but it also probably will blow up. And so we make sure that our heads don't blow up. Okay. So here is a fact that you know, which is, if I have this circle and then I cut off an epsilon peel, right, the amount that is left is r minus epsilon radius. The area of that, you know, we are talking about, you know, for two-dimensional thing, volume would be area. So it would be square divided by r square. So that means for two-dimensional case, it's r minus epsilon by r square. For three dimensions, it will be r minus epsilon by r cube. For a million dimensions, it will be r minus epsilon by r power million. What's interesting about r minus epsilon by r? It's a number less than 1. You successively exponentiate it, it'll drive it down to 0. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes.
A million dimensional apple is all peel, no core. There is no apple there. So don't ever peel a million dimensional apple. Okay? And similarly, another interesting thing is that if you have a million dimensional space, two random vectors two randomly generated vectors, what is the probability that two randomly generated vectors are going to be orthogonal to each other? That means their dot product would be zero. It turns out that probability is extremely high. It's low in two dimensions, because your intuitions are in two dimensions. You can generate large number of vectors and say, hey, they are not perpendicular, so dot product is not zero. In million dimensional spaces, once again, it turns out that most randomly generated vectors are perpendicular to each other. So aren't you happy that the documents are not randomly generated? Right? If they were, then all the similarities in the vector similarity would be zero. So you're just picking which zero is better. Yes. At the left. I'm assuming that most of us peel so that we eat the rest of the apple. What I want to know is how much apple is left. So what I'm looking at here is, this is the R minus epsilon cube for a three-dimensional apple is the volume proportional to the, this is the volume of the apple left as a fraction of the original apple. And the only thing that matters is R minus epsilon by R is less than 1. However little less, it is less. And you exponentiate a number less than 1, indefinitely, you will get a 0. That's just as good as day and night. And this is not surprising to you. You know this. But you don't put it together with that. But that's how we live. We don't necessarily. Intuition essentially is our ability to not put together our knowledge completely. Right? And so our intuitions about n dimensions tend to be wrong. So, however, mostly I will think in terms of vectors, vector spaces, and the mathematics of vector spaces is the same in n dimensions too. But your intuitions may or may not hold. That's all I'm saying. Okay? So, now going back to the dot product distance, if I divided the dot product distance by the two magnitudes, what do I get? It turns out that is actually cos theta. That's again linear algebra. If you have two vectors, v1 and v2, you take the dot product of those two vectors, divide it by the magnitudes of those two vectors, that will be actually equal to cosine theta. So cosine theta is really nothing but normalized dot product distance. Look at all the beauty of connections. Cosine theta is nothing but normalized Euclidean distance. I'm sorry, normalized dot product distance. Okay? So now the question is, what's the difference between cosine theta, which is normalized dot product distance, and the other one that I talked about, which is normalized Euclidean distance, which is two unit vectors, and then take the distance between the two tips. Clearly, it's somewhat kind of connected to theta, but it's not exactly the same. Okay. The interesting thing is, I'll show you a picture basically later on. In general, people find, people have done experimentation and found that the cosine theta similarity metric tends to capture people's view of similarity between documents better than the normalized Euclidean distance similarity metric. And this is the kind of thing I can't easily prove, so I'll show you a picture. Apparently, picture is worth 1,000 words, so I'll show you one. Okay? So that's basically the lecture for the first half of the class today. And then I need to kind of run through the slides, which say the same thing, except on the slides. Okay? Okay, so this vector model. So each document is a vector in some n-dimensional space. Now, obviously, we are assuming that each keyword is a dimension. And normally, we assume that all dimensions are perpendicular to each other. Right? And so they're all orthogonal dimensions. Now, what that means is that all the keywords or all the words in the document are independent of each other. Okay? Now, what that basically means is, whatever I tell you about how many times a particular word is present in a document, you will never be able to say anything more about whether or not this other word is going to be present in the document. Suppose I asked you, what do you think is the probability that this document I have in my hand has the word science in it? Suppose you just made 0.3. 0.3 is the probability for whatever reason. Now I'll give you some more evidence. I look into the document and say, hey, I think this document seems to have 18 instances of the word computer. Would you like to change your probability? Okay? If you were to change your probability, that means computer and science are not independent. Okay? Because that's again the definition of conditional probabilities. That's the definition of conditional probabilities, right? So A and B are independent if P A given B is the same as P of A. So how much ever I tell you about how many instances of computer are there, you don't change your mind about what the probability of science being present. If you think this is true for every pair of words in the world, then you can actually say vectors can be really seen as, you know, this can be seen as vectors in n-dimensional orthogonal, n-dimensional space with n orthogonal bases. If you don't, then you know that you are making a gross simplification. But then this is not the first time we are making gross simplifications. We started with an English document and said it's just a bag of words or a vector of words, which lost a lot of semantics of the document anyway. So it's just one more mistake we'll make, one more, you know, simplification we make. Okay? So the question is it a reasonable assumption? Is it reasonable to assume that all words are independent? Actually, it's not. But all you need to do is to do better than your competitor. And it turns out that if you compare vector similarity metric to Jaccard similarity metric or Euclidean distance similarity metric, it does just as well. No worse, no better. More or less in the same ballpark. Okay. However, as I said earlier, the vector similarity with the vectors as the semantics of our documents, we can use linear algebra and reason about dependence and independence between dimensions. And one nice technical topic we'll talk about maybe a week, 2 weeks from, maybe a week and a half from now, is latent semantic indexing, which is essentially figuring out that even though you think there are three words really with three different dimensions, what you really have is two dimensions, because the third dimension is just a linear combination of the first two. Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay? So we'll talk about that then. So, but keep that in mind, that this is an assumption we are making. And then, so a similar, the query will be a vector, and the document would be a vector in the space, in the same space. And then you want to compute their distances. This is an unnormalized Euclidean distance. You can normalize it by taking the unit vector in those document directions. You can also compute unnormalized dot product distance, which I mentioned. Okay, both the unnormalized dot product and unnormalized Euclidean have this problem that they depend on the length of the document. Not the distribution of the words, but the length of the document. If you normalize it in any which way, by, you know, to, so that, you know, the length doesn't affect, then you will have normalized measure. Okay, so you have a normalized Euclidean measure and then the normalized dot product measure, and the normalized dot product measure is nothing but cosine theta similarity metric. Okay, that's basically it. And then, so cosine theta similarity, when theta equal to zero, then the two vectors are the same, and so they are identical as far as you are concerned. And so cosine of zero is one, so similarity would be one. If the two documents are perpendicular to each other in this n-dimensional space, then it would be cos of 90 degrees. And you would get a zero, which is the similarity. Why can't it be 270 degrees between the documents? Why can't it be 320 degrees between the documents? I mean, again, you're all coming, I mean, at one point of time you did, yes.
Because you can't have negative.
Exactly. Okay, math applied to your application. Okay, this is math. But you will not have 270 degrees between any two documents because you are stuck in the first quadrant. All your vectors are in the first quadrant. Because you cannot have negative three instances of computer in this document. Do you see what I'm saying? Okay, that's why you really need to care between 0 and 90, that's it. Okay, fine. So, if I were to consider this example, remember this example I mentioned that these first five, remember these are the terms, T1, T2, T3, up to T6. These first three terms are database, SQL, and index. The last three terms are regression, likelihood, and linear. Okay, and as I said, in some sense, these first three, any document which has mostly these first three terms is probably a database document, and any document that has these three terms mostly is probably a statistics document or a book. Okay, and notice that I'm thinking of indexing the document only in terms of some of its words, just the keywords. That's fine. You know, the theory works whether you index it in terms of keywords or all words. Okay, so that's the case. And so what I want to now find is I can compute the document-to-document similarity matrix. So there are 10 documents. I want to compute DIDJ similarity for each I and J. Now, obviously, this matrix, similarity matrix, would be symmetric because I is as similar to J as J is to I. I mean, all the similarity matrix we have done till now are like that. Okay, so if I were to then compute that, and then I were to draw this picture such that the similarity, remember similarity will be, I'm only looking at normalized ones. So similarity is between 0 and 1. And so if I look at similarity close to 1, I will make that point to be white. Okay, and if it is 0, I'll make it black. Anywhere between 1 and 0, I'll make it different shades of gray. Okay, so I will then show you a picture of the document-to-document similarity matrix here. Okay, and so all this is basically saying is anything that's white, that means they're very similar to each other. Okay, now this document, and then anything that's dark, that means it's not really that similar to that document. Okay, so for example, this is D5. This particular thing is 5 and 10. So this is a representation of the similarity between document 10 and document 5. And all this is saying is they're not very similar at all, according to Euclidean measure. And this picture shows the same thing, except the distances are now computed. The similarities are computed using vector similarity. That's it. So which would you like?
Euclidean.
You like Euclidean?
Yeah.
Why? So the thing is, so first of all of them will have white on the main axis. That's not surprising, because if you are not similar to yourself, you have major identity problems, right? Okay. And so everybody will be thinking. The real question is, notice that cosine theta basically says all the first five documents are more similar to each other. Okay? And then it also shows, for example, that the D5 to D10 are less similar to each other. And so in some sense, it smooths over the similarity and is able to capture your intuition that these guys form sort of a cluster and these guys form a cluster. Whereas the Euclidean sort of splits hairs. It is saying between, so in fact, the way Euclidean is going, you can very easily, suppose, notice that you have squares here which are of the same sort of a color as the squares here, which means one of the documents here might actually be more similar to a document from the statistics side than it is to other databases side. If you think that's a feature, then you like this. If you think it's a bug, then you don't like this. Okay, most people think that, you know, this is a feature, that's a bug, in the sense that in this particular example, you would really like your ranking to be able to see that the database guys are more or less, you know, close to each other. You know, there may be small variations, but they're much more close to each other. So the idea is somehow within a cluster, there may still be distances, but the distances within the cluster better be smaller than the distances across the cluster. That's something that's captured here. So this is as good an argument as you can ever get as to why we like cosine theta similarity matrix as against normalized Euclidean distance similarity matrix. This is it. I can't do anything better than this. Okay? The rest I could have said, if you don't agree with this, then I say everybody just uses cosine theta similarity matrix. That's pretty much what they do. Okay, and the second question is why cosine theta, I mean why vector versus bag? I already told you, because vectors allow you to generalize the interpretations to handle independence of vectors, which will come very soon actually. Okay, so that's basically between these. And so after this slide, then I'll just assume until I, unless you know I tell you otherwise, when I say distance between two documents, I'm going to compute it using cosine theta similarity metric. Okay, that's what I'll assume. Okay, you should know all the pluses and minuses of the various things, but we'll, for the class, we'll stick to this mostly. Okay, and then of course, if I am computing the distance between the query and the document, then I think of query also as a mini document. It's a vector in the space of the, in the same space as the document is, and I compute the distance between these two vectors. Okay, right? So here is an example that we are doing. Basically, my query is database and index, and remember that my terms are T1 to T6, right? So if database and index, then 1, 0, 1, 0, 0, 0. That's what it should be. 1, 0, 1, 0, 0, 0. That's what my vector is. Okay, this is my vector, and each of these documents are their own vector. This is just unadorned, you know, view of query as a vector in the same space. Okay, and now I can compute the cosine theta similarity metric between these, and then I will notice that the numbers I get, if I just plug in, you know, these are the vectors, and this is one more vector for each of, you know, query and each of the documents, I compute the cosine theta similarity metric. It's just plugging it into that formula, which is dot product divided by the magnitudes of both the query and the document. Okay, if I do that, then I will get 0.70, 0.77, 0.58, 0.60, 0.79, 0.14, 0.06, 0.02, 0.09, 0.01. Now, one of the homework problems would be for you to confirm this, that is actually true, that if you were to just plug it in. You know, I know that it's correct, but you know, if you plug it in, you will know for sure that it is correct. Okay, so now the interesting thing is that, first of all, you do see that the first five are much closer to the query than the last five, which sort of is with respect to your intuition that database index query is closer to database things than the statistics books. Okay, so the other thing is that if I were to rank them in the order of their similarity, I would say D5, then D2, then D1, then D3, then D4. That's my top five documents. So you have your search engine now. So you have a query, you have a way of computing the similarity, and you know how to do sorting. Right? Okay, so the rest of what we'll do here is how to improve this a little bit more in terms of the similarity computation, one part. And the second part is how to represent documents and queries in the computer such that this operation would be as efficient as possible, because you could do it quite badly. That's the inverted indexing approach, a point. Okay, and if you understand those two, then you will be able to do project one. I also kind of understood like the first important part of IR, right? Okay, any questions? Yes. Yes, I'm sorry.
Again, it depends on the number of words present in the
document. No, right now I did not, all I did is remember that each document, I mean, remember that I'm doing normalized. That means the query has a certain length, each document has a length. After I compute the query and the document dot product, I am dividing it by the query size and the document size. So in a sense, I am making some amends for the size of the document. It turns out that's not enough. I mean, that's what we'll talk about next minute. Okay, I mean, but we are taking into account the size of the document. Okay, to do the next part, you need to understand a little bit more about how words are distributed across, you know, documents. Yes?
So going back to the picture you had, Euclidean would be seen maybe as we go and cosine as precision.
I don't know. I mean, no, I think you can get precision and recall for both of these, because if you want to get top 10, I will give you all top 10. It's just that the lowest one has very low similarity. Unless you put an artificial threshold and said anything below that similarity is not at all a result, I will give you all the results. The real question is the order in which I give them.
Yes.
So what Euclidean is likely to do is it will probably give you in the top 5 some statistics. I mean, given this picture, I would think that Euclidean is likely to give you some statistics documents interspersed in the middle of database documents in the first 5. Again, all of this, I'm saying it as an oracular fashion. First of all, you should all know, you know, this use of the word oracle. The other day, I even tried to crack something and nobody understood. It's not the oracle of Larry Ellison, but this is the Delphic oracle. Okay, an oracle basically knows everything. It's better than the user and the system. You know, it's like all-seeing seer. Okay, and we compute precisions and recalls and, you know, and the right way of ranking, etc., from this oracular sense. In normal time, when you give a query, you will get some number of documents. You don't know which one is better. You just, you know, you'll say that my similarity metric gave me these documents. And what's even more pernicious, and at some point of time I'll tell you this, that if you try to actually evaluate what users consider relevant, it's not even clear whether users have any idea what is relevant. In fact, there was a study where people were trying to check whether the fact that Google gives a result at the top means the user thinks that must be what they're looking for, which is kind of pushing everything upside down, right? I mean, you should be looking for something, and then you see whether Google is giving it. But, you know, a sufficiently effective technology can make you feel the other way around. Yeah, maybe I shouldn't have been looking for that other thing. You know, Google says this is what I should be looking for. And so there was a very carefully constructed study that has been done at Cornell, where essentially what they did was they considered, you know, Google's top 10 always, except in one case, without telling the users, in one case it's just the Google's top 10. In the other case, they just changed the order of the top 1 and 2. And users consistently like the top one. That's what we really wanted, which they couldn't tolerate, right? Because obviously we're changing the order. What does that mean? Because we just assume that Google knows better than us. So whatever I am asking for, they will tell me what I really need. Now, you know, all those issues also come into these oracular studies. You know, who is to tell? You know, if the user is very happy, then can you tell them that you shouldn't be this happy? You know, and you can't make too much money, you know, telling people to be unhappy. Okay, but you know, that's the issue of ranking. And in answer to your query, you can rank these. It's just that, you know, you may get interspersed some of the database and statistics documents, and you will never know. In this case, you can tell, but this is just an illustrative example. This is not a proof. Yes. Exactly. So we'll do it faster. That's what indexing and retrieval is all about. Okay. All sorts of things have to be done, but we'll do at least some. Okay. Yes.
I just wanted to know why the cosine gave a different black and white color.
I don't know. I just plotted it. I don't look like a cosine to you, right? So I don't know what it does. This is what it is. That's the interesting thing. Since it did it like this, then you know we should like it. That's the nice part. Okay, it's able to actually tell. So think about it this way. I mean, I always felt that there should be as many grades as there are number of students in the class. Why? My life would be very simple. Okay, and I'm slowly getting there. You know, when I first came to USU, there only used to be A, B, C, D, E. That's it. Now there is A plus, A minus, B, B minus, C plus, C minus. No, there is no C, there is C minus. There is no D plus apparently. There's just D. And then F. Okay, so I have more people. So if I can make enough of you drop so that there are enough, as many grades left as there are people, then I don't need to do this hard work of what is this mark supposed to be in the letter grade. I'm trying to look for equivalence classes. Anybody can say these 10 are different documents. The question is in how many equivalence classes are they falling? Anybody can tell that the 47 or so students here are all individuals. The question is, can I put them in some reasonable equivalence classes? Okay, and so, you know, you don't want to believe that being able to split hairs is a feature. It could be a bug. You know, me telling everybody that, you know, their social security number is their grade, and that way everybody will be unique. Okay, so, but you know, the fact that it is actually seeing the equivalence classes is an argument in its favor. Okay, so this is fine. This is just directly with respect to terms. So the two other aspects that we want to consider is, yes, these things are normalizing with respect to the document length, but they do assume that all words are created equal, both within the document and across the documents. And so what you really want to do is, if, for example, a document has 25 instances of the word computer, but then its total number of words is 5,000, that's different from another document which has 25 instances of the word computer, but the total number of words there is only 100. Okay, to some extent, this is what you think normalization is supposed to capture, but really what I want to know, essentially, is which words in this document are really important words, which are indicative of the true class of this document. Believe it or not, when we used to think in terms of keywords, librarians used to think in terms of keywords, one can argue that keywords are less dependent on each other than normal words are, because keywords are a very small subset. I am any day going to believe that there are about 1,000 orthogonal categories than to believe that there are about 10 million orthogonal categories. Coming up with keywords, basically, somebody comes up with keywords, they probably already made sure that they're enough different from each other. So what I really would like to do is sort of, rather than just look at the raw frequencies of words, somehow normalize the frequencies of words themselves, such that they tell us this following information: how indicative this word is of this document. Okay? Now, how indicative of this word is of this document? So, I am standing in front of you. Give me some features that I have right now. For example, I have a t-shirt. Clearly indicative, if I remove my t-shirt, you'll all run, and you know, it's sort of indicative of me, right? Is that a good, and I also have 10 fingers. So it looks like my fingers are more indicative of me than my t-shirt, which is only one. So Rao has 10 fingers, one t-shirt. So somehow fingers are more important than, you know, shirt. That's how we are looking at it. Okay. Now first of all, think about this. Is my t-shirt indicative at all? Are my 10 fingers indicative? Everybody has 10 fingers. You know, I mean, it's like a Martian coming to this universe will think, this world will think, all of you are so boringly alike. Okay, you all have the same number of eyes, same number of noses. Where is the design freedom? You know, why not put a few extra eyes and a couple of extra noses? This, you know, infinite number of possibilities of design looks like, you know, you guys evolved in a reasonably boring fashion. Okay, so most of the things that we share with each other are useless in distinguishing us from each other. So what do? The first thing we do when we grow up, we start ignoring the things that we have common with each other. As soon as the first standard, you know, teacher tells you we're all created equal, we should share, etc. After that, we'll ignore that and we'll say, no, that person has a much bigger cookie bag than I do, or that person has something. The important thing is the differences, not what we share. So my t-shirt is useless because you do have one. This, on the other hand, is extremely useful because none of you seem to be sporting one of these. Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay, and so if I want to blend in, I should avoid wearing, like, you know, shirt, like I shouldn't wear, for example, full Indian formal regalia and walk around in, you know, Mill Avenue and expect that people will sort of think I'm just, you know, born and bred Arizonan, right? Why? Because I'm looking different. I mean, I'm basically made sure that my features have no connection with anybody else's features. If I want to blend in, I will basically try my best wearing the same sort of thing everybody is wearing. How many of you know the Alibaba and the 40 Thieves story, where the thieves come and basically the next day they're going to come to Alibaba's home, and I mean the next night, so that during the daytime they go and put a cross on the house they know is Alibaba's. So the night they will come and do bad things. right? And then Alibaba's girlfriend, who took IR course of some sort, basically what does it do? What does she do? She doesn't remove the cross. Removing the cross is silly, because if you remove the cross, then you leave some marks. Okay? All she does is puts the same cross everywhere. That's it. Okay? So, if you have the same feature as everybody, it's useless feature. First things first. It's true that it kind of gives us some kind of a kumbaya notion that we're all together. But we are not into kumbaya when we're doing, you know, IR. We want to see this document is somehow better than this document for this query. So each of them should advertise themselves on their distinguishing features. Okay? So the first point I made is, if a word appears in every document, it is useless. So a word that appears in this document that doesn't seem to appear in most other documents is much more useful than one which appears in everybody. Okay, so what I would like to think of there is this notion, of I want to take number of documents with the number of documents in the corpus divided by the num documents having word W. This is sort of the importance of the word is proportional to the number of documents in the corpus divided by the number of documents having that word. So if in fact only one document has that word, then this would be a million documents in the corpus by one. So it's million important. If everybody has that word, then million by million will be one. It will be one important. Okay? Got it, right? So all I want to do now is play with that intuition and say, I want to make one to be zero and million to be a little smaller. What do? Find a monotonic function which cuts down the magnitudes, logarithms. Okay? So if I take log of this, it has all the properties we wanted, right? So log of this would be large for log of million, so, and it's still larger than log of one, which is zero. Okay, so one important idea is this measure. I would go with this measure. Log of number of documents in the corpus by the number of documents which have this word. And this measure is called IDF, inverse document frequency. It's actually log of the inverse document frequency. Okay? Yes? So suppose I have a million documents, okay, and the word computer occurs in 25 of them, then the importance of the word computer, in fact the IDF of the word computer, is equal to log of 1 million by 25. Okay? Again, you will have enough time to make sure that you got the formula right. The most important thing is, do you know why the formula makes sense? If it makes sense, these are simple formulas. You can derive them in like 3 seconds. You should never do it the opposite way, because if you do it the opposite way, then you are saying, if everybody has that feature, then it's a good feature. Well, it is a good feature to talk about what. So here's the interesting thing. Suppose if Martians were to go back to Mars, and they have, you know, made a trip to Earth, looked at us, they went to planet Uranus, looked at people there, people like thingies there, and then they went back to Mars and they're writing, like, you know, here is a description of humans. Here's a description of, you know, Uranian people. Okay? They better not say the most important feature is that one guy has this. It's useless. What makes me unique is also the most useless characteristic of the common human experience. What they really are going to say is all humans seem to have 10 fingers, just 2 eyes and 1 funny nose in between them, and they all think as if they're different from each other. That is also universal. We all think we are unique. okay, despite all these, you know, common things that we have. So that's what you would do to describe the entire cluster called Earth. The cluster description would need to consider, for example, words that are more common for that cluster and less common across clusters. So if in fact it turns out that people in Uranus also have a nose but only have one eye, then the two eyes is a better description of Earthian, you know, people than one nose, because one nose everybody seems to have. It's the same idea. And I'm not, you know, really into interplanetary science here. You will eventually write clusters. You will find clusters and you will write descriptions of clusters. Remember when, you know, Google gives you like a synopsis of a page, right? One of the most interesting questions is, you know, when it gives you a document, the best thing it can say is the results are document number 78958985, document number 83848578, etc., the top 10. And what is there not to like? And by the way, first part of your project will let you do that. And then basically, because that's easier to do, just give the document identifier as the result. What you want is a quick description of the document before you take the time to click on that document. You know, if you're going to click on the document anyway, I told you, you should believe me. And you know, if I tell you that D78597875 is the best document, you should just click on it. But I try to convince you that I am right. How do I convince you that I am right? I have to give you words from the document that will tell you, first of all, that the document satisfies the query, that some words from the query are present in the document. And second of all, it gives you a sense of what makes this document, as against every other document. So interestingly, synopsis computation of documents will have to take IDF into account. Like for example, you know, the word the or the word, you know, the word computer in a computer science document repository is useless as part of synopsis because every document has that. Okay? So it's a pretty big idea, this IDF thing, basically, because you're trying to capture, it is really the tip of the iceberg of trying to figure out what features should we represent a document by. And we punted that question by saying we'll represent the document by all its words. But not all its words are equally good at predicting it. In fact, there's also a bigger question as to whether all its words are enough of a description of the document. In fact, if I told you that Netscape, the page, didn't have the word browser in it, which is like the most important characteristic of that page, and it's not there in it. So even if you give all words, you may still be dead. Okay, but all words clearly are not created equal. Some of them are more indicative of what makes this document, and some are less indicative. And IDF tries to capture that. And a related idea is TF. Within the same document, if you consider multiple words in the document which have the same IDF, then the word that has more instances of that word in the document is probably more representative of that document. Do you see what I'm saying? Suppose it turns out that, you know, I have like two horns on my head, which will be high IDF, right? Because none of you have horns, right? Now somebody else has only one horn, right? Both the having the feature horn is equally high IDF. Nobody else seems to have it. We two are the contenders for this prize you're about to give. Who would get it? Me, because I have two of them. Whatever you are liking, I have two of them. But I also have 10 fingers, but you don't care about it because everybody has 10 fingers. Do you see what I'm saying? So first you capture IDF, which is what features are important, and then you capture which document has more of those features. That's TF, term frequency. And the normalized term frequency is just nothing but number of instances of TF of a word W is number of instances of word W in the document divided by the maximum instances of any word in the document. Okay? So I'm just normalizing it with respect to, so suppose this word is present 25 times, But if everybody else is present 1800, you know, the maximum instant, the word that is present most is present 1800 times, then 25 isn't all that great. If on the other hand, this is present 25 times, and the word that is maximally present is only present 5 times, I'm sorry, it cannot be 5 times, you know, if maximally present is present 25 times, because nothing can be less than 25, because this word is part of the document, then it will be 1. Right? So TF is now going to be between 1 and 0. 1 if, in fact, the word you're looking at is the most frequent word in the document. And closer to 0 if it is one of the least frequent words in the document. I need both. Remember, two horns and the fact that horns are important in this class because nobody else seems to have it. Okay? So, I want both. What do? I take TF of W times IDF of W. And say that is the normalized weight of the word W. Do you see this? That's where the most often used acronym in IR comes in, which is TF-IDF ranking. It's just common sense. You want to weight words both by their inverse document frequency, that tells you how indicative that word is about this document, and the term frequency, which is how frequent this word is with respect to other words in the document. Between TF and IDF, which is a local feature with respect to your document and which is a global feature with respect to your document? TF is local, IDF is global. Please remember this. I mean, I'm not going to ask questions on this, but you know, it's an important issue. IDF basically can only be captured if you know other documents. You can leave me alone and change the IDF of a word, but you can't change the TF of a word without changing me, if me being a document. Okay, that's what the Alibaba girlfriend did. She left everybody else's, left this house alone and just put cross on every other house. That just drove down the IDF to 0. Then 0 times anything is still 0. So you're fine. Right? Okay? So that's basically this. Term weights in the vector model. You want to really, ideally, a term weighting should solve the feature selection problem. This is what I was trying to say. I mean, this, what is in red is what this entire argument about, you know, my horns and my t-shirt, etc. Ultimately, what you're trying to find is not an undifferentiated description of Rao, but a differentiated description of Rao that differentiates Rao from everybody else. Right? And so in that case, you really are looking for what are the features that are indicative of Rao. Now, if you're thinking that features of Rao are the words, features of a document are the words in the document, then you want to see which words are more indicative of the document and which are less indicative of the document. And that depends on both the inverse document frequency and the term frequency. And you compute both of them, multiply one by the other, you get TF-IDF weight. Now you would write the document in the TF-IDF weight form. So it's now still a vector. It's just a vector with different weights. A vector with different weights is a different vector. Right? So if I have, here is a vector, here is another vector. It's just a vector with different weights. It just has a different x value and a different y value, but it's a different vector. You change the weights, you change the vector. If you change all weights by the same constant, you don't change the vector, because the unit vector would be still the same. If you change one more than the other, then you are changing the direction of the vector. Then it's a different vector altogether, and cosine theta would be different. You see that? Okay. So TF-IDF basically is a normalized TF factor is given by frequency of the word in the document divided by the maximum of any word in that document, maximum frequency of any word in the document. IDF is nothing but a log of number of documents divided by the number of documents that have this word I. And you take log for two good reasons, at least, one is that log of one is zero, the other is IDF otherwise can be much larger than TF, because the size of the document corpus would be like 8 billion and counting, right? Whereas the size of the document itself probably is much smaller. Okay, so TF weights are always smaller. IDF weights can become 8 billion or something. So they can completely kill the TF weight. So you take logarithm to kind of get them into the same place. And then, of course, I can make a nice, interesting argument as to why this is sort of a reasonable thing to do from an information theoretic perspective. But I won't do it right now. Okay, if you understand this, that's good enough, that it's a reasonable way to do it. Okay, so log is used to make the values of TF and IDF comparable. It can also be interpreted as the amount of information associated with the term KI. And those of you who have heard of information theory might make sense of it. If not, that's okay right now. Okay? The other question, of course, is what do we do for queries? Now, of course, I can just do the same thing for queries too. Okay, so notice that by now I have actually changed the weights of the document. So now each weight of the word I would be, the TF of that word I times of the IDF of that word I in the document. So each document now corresponds to a different row. Okay, so let me go forward and say, first of all, that if this is my original document, remember, when I do the TF IDF, I'll get these documents. Once again, you know, this is going to be homework. You're going to check whether that's true. Okay? So you believe first, and what's this Regan said, trust but verify. So trust me, but verify afterwards in the homework. Okay? So notice that obviously this is different. These numbers are different. Not only are the numbers different, there is no clear-cut evidence as to, like for example, the 24 became 2.53. which you would have thought 21 should become something close to 2 point something, but it actually became 14.56. It's capturing the intuitions. You know, it's like a 10 finger, no big deal. One hand, wow, that's like a huge deal. It's capturing that, right? So it's now a different vector altogether. So now if I were to compute the distances between these documents, TF-IDF distances, vector similarity between these vectors, in this TF, after the TF-IDF change, those similarities will be different. And they hopefully will be better. They'll be more closer to our intuition. Okay, the other final thing is that, so if I'm giving a query, in this case, database and index, so once again, I can, right now, in this slide, I'm assuming, I'll leave the query as it is. So I'll just say 101000. So I'm not doing TF-IDF to the query itself. Why? Because query really doesn't have enough words. Okay? It doesn't have enough words. And already the documents have taken the IDF into account. So why should queries take IDF into account?
But what about giving statistics of queries over time?
That's a different story. So that's having a query log. Okay, we are now assuming the query just came and we're going to answer this.
But that would be reasonable?
Yes. Learning is always reasonable. Remember, we got into this because we wanted one-size-fits-all solution. Understand the one-size-fits-all solution, but learning of any kind is always reasonable. It's just costlier. Okay? If I have this query, then I can compute the distance between this vector, cosine theta distance between this vector and each of those vectors. And that is represented as a TF-IDF distance. And this was the TF distance. I'm just giving it to you. To see, well, you can stare at it and see whether one is any better than the other. In this case, good thing is that you still are saying that the same, remember this was the same query, right? We saw before, D5 was seen as the most relevant document before, if you were to show the most similar document first, but now I'm saying D2 is actually more similar. You can see whether that makes sense to you. You know, you should have really woken up if in fact I said D10 is the more similar document. Because that's a statistics document, this is a database query. That's not the question. It's just within the cluster, I said some other document is better. Okay, that's your TF-IDF. This is what you would implement for your first project. The indexing part we'll talk next class. The only other thing I'm going to say here is, while I left the query unchanged, which is a very reasonable thing to do, some people also do some things to the query. For example, here is, you know, a popular method in IR, I think, is called the OCAPI method, where basically they just, without any good reason, say this is what we'll do for the queries. Okay? So the way the queries weights are computed, remember that normal weights are computed TF times IDF. Okay. So the query weight, this is the IDF part, but for the TF part, they are realizing that some words may not even exist in the query. So you add a 0.5 to any word that doesn't exist. So you start it off with a 0.5. Plus 0.5 times the TF. Do you see what I'm saying? So you actually compute the TF of that that word with respect to the query, but then rather than just go with it, you multiply that by 0.5 and add a 0.5 to begin with. And then you multiply that by the IDF. I cannot really justify it too much as to why this makes sense. It sort of actually works well in what? In the TREC competition. Remember TREC that I told you? You know, IR folks have this competition. In TREC competitions, this seems to have worked fine compared to this. Slightly better compared to this. Okay? And then, of course, you can also say, let the user give weights to the keywords to reflect their real preferences. That's not a bad idea. Right? You could do that. But then, you know, depending on users doesn't necessarily, you know, other than, okay, this is if the user does give real preference. So here's the issue. Suppose you were to say computer science to Google and say computer science to Google, and if it gives different answers, you know what Google is doing. So IR as a natural science, you get to do experiments on Google, you know, poke it this way, that way, and see how frogs work and how Google works. Okay, you will actually see that computer science will give you different results than computer science. So one way you can increase, if you were to be interested in that, the way you can increase the relative importance of a keyword is write more copies of that and less copies of other keyword. But this is because you understood so much, you're so smart, you're a graduate student, you're an undergrad student, you know, bozos, including us, most of the time don't know what we're looking for, and we just feel like writing the computer science and assume the is just as important as computer, as important as science. Okay, so we'll stop here. Next class we'll do the indexing and retrieval. That would, once you understand that, you have everything for the project one.